to come up to maybe the podium, or would you be more comfortable sitting there?
Either way. I'm not going to use slides.
So. It's okay. I'm done. So can we turn the slides off? Whichever you're more comfortable in. Jim Tudestad, as you know, is the President Emeritus of the University of Michigan. He was president from 1988 to 1996. Now, I was at the University of Michigan through all of those years, so I observed significant change on the campus. The North Campus of the University of Michigan was a cow pasture prior to Jim Tudestad. I may be exaggerating a little, but it is now an incredibly vibrant campus, if you've ever been there. It has music, architecture, and engineering. It has a bell tower. It has a sense of vitality. And it has a building that was used to be called the Media Union, that was a product of Jim Tudestad's work as president. And the Media Union was a state-funded, I think it was something like $50 million, $40, $50 million at that time. Brand new concept. We're going to create a building that is for collaboration, multidisciplinary collaboration, faculty groups coming in, going out. We're going to instrument with the highest of high information technology, and we're going to see what happens. Well, what happens is that the students glommed onto that. It's like 24 hours a day, the commons, intellectual commons, and it's been renamed the Dude. In honor of Jim Tudestad, used to be the Media Union. So I could give you a long list of his attributes, but National Medal of Technology, chair of the National Science Board, senior leadership in the academies, chairing many pivotal NRC committees on the future of public higher education. He's written books on the university of the 21st century, intercollegiate athletics in the American university, a view from the president, a view from the helm, and the future of the public university. And I've read all these books. And the future of the public university has the word crossroads in it. And this is about 2000. And you can see my little presentation here is really derived from the mentoring I've got over the years from Jim. Also an expert on lifelong learning and the role of information technology in infusing and economic development. And if you go to the Michigan Daily website, you'll find a quote there that he's a giant of policy and philosophy, not just in public higher education, but on the future of society in the 21st century. So Jim, with that, you get to tell us what we should be thinking about.
Great. Thank you very much, Tim. Let me first apologize for not having slides, but when I spent about an hour with Tim last night, this is what happened to my talk. Well, it's quite an honor to be back. It's a little bit of deja vu because I appeared in this room before this group, and the only thing that has changed is you have a new president and a new board chair. What I'd like to do is to first recognize that, in my view, the four great public research universities in this country, the University of California, University of Wisconsin, University of Illinois, and University of Michigan, would rank among the top 10 most significant institutions in this country and indeed throughout the world. They have extraordinary capacity and extraordinary impact. What I'd like to do is to make some comments from four different perspectives. First, from the national perspective, as you probably know, Congress asked the national academies several years ago to do a major study on the future of the American research university. It happens to be in my part of the National Academy, the Division of Policy and Global Affairs, which I chair. And it launched a decade-long effort, which is well underway right now. But I thought I'd comment a bit on the implications of that for your strategic planning process. Second, I'll move to the regional level. You've received a copy of the kind of master plan I did for the Chicago Council and for the Brookings Institution. There again, there are certain, I think, ideas come out of that. I thought I'd take a third perspective, kind of looking over the border a little bit from Ann Arbor, kind of looking at how our institution is struggling and maybe some guidelines out of that. And then finally, I'll home in on the University of Illinois itself and make a few comments. I should say that several weeks ago, I returned from a Davos-like meeting in Switzerland that I co-chair every 2 years, where we bring together a couple of dozen university presidents from the top universities around the world, and spend several days drinking a lot of Swiss wine and eating a lot of Swiss food, having a lot of fun and talking about things. And we usually bring in people to stir them up, and both Tim and Roberta came in several years ago to stir them up. But I can make some comments on that as well. Let me first move to the national level. This reflected, I think, the growing reality that today we live in a hyper-competitive, global, knowledge-driven economy and society. And this is a society that's increasingly dependent on innovation, on education, on infrastructure, the three great contributions of research universities. Universities, through research, produce the knowledge key to innovation. Through their educational program, they create knowledge workers, entrepreneurs. And through the development and deployment of advanced infrastructures, the internet is an example. The leadership, for example, of University of Illinois and producing much of the computer information technology that we use, form the foundations of the knowledge economy. During our study, our economists estimated that 2 years, about 40 to 60% of the economic growth of this country is driven by R&D, another 20% by the increasing skills of our workforce, both of which trace back to our campuses. In fact, in a recent survey, when asked to identify the one federal policy that could most increase long-term economic growth in this nation, the economists put investment in education and research at the top of that list. Other nations realize this. Unfortunately, the United States right now tends to be taking it more for granted. And that was one of the reasons why Congress, several years ago, led by Lamar Alexander and Barbara Mikulski of the Senate, Bart Gordon and Ralph Hall of the House, asked us to do a major study because of their concern that research universities in this country were at risk. This two-year study involved, led by Chad Holliday, a former CEO of DuPont and currently chair of the board of Bank of America, but it was equally balanced between leaders from business, from the federal government, a number of university presidents, and a number of faculty, including two Nobel laureates. They identified the following primary concerns: the degree that federal policies no longer place a priority on university research and graduate education. We estimate that we've lost about 20% over the last decade in federal support, particularly basic research. That aging populations in the states are driving priority for state funds increasingly to health care, to corrections, to tax relief, and away from higher education. The public research universities in our study had lost on the average of about 35 to 40% of their state support since the year 2000. Business and industry largely have abandoned basic research, focusing much more on applied research and development. Bell Labs no longer exist. They're turning to the campuses for the basic research, but they're not providing the support for that. And in fact, industry research of support of campus-based research is less than 5% across the country. And then finally, although universities, particularly public universities, with the loss of state support, are making strong efforts to achieve enhanced efficiency, productivity, the public doesn't believe it. They see climbing walls and sushi bars that we all build in our residence halls to attract out-of-state students, international students that can pay high out-of-state tuition. But all of this coming together, the most serious conclusion that was reached in 2 years of hearing was the most valuable component of the nation's knowledge, research, and innovation structure, its public universities, was the part that was very much at risk. John Hennessy, who was on our group, president of Stanford, put it this way: the states are methodically dismantling their public universities, where the majority of the nation's campus research is conducted, where two-thirds of its scientists, engineers, physicians, teachers, and other knowledge professionals are produced. Beyond that, we see today the tragedy and, in fact, the extraordinary act of ignorance as leaders of many of our states choose to savage their flagship research universities for personal political gain. Wisconsin, Virginia, North Carolina, Missouri, Kansas, Texas, Arizona, Florida, Louisiana, and in a strange way, Indiana, where I've been involved for the last several days. The message here is, in a sense, a call to the arms to the states, because their devastating cuts and intrusive regulation have imposed on public research universities is not only harming their future, but it's harming the future of the nation. If you think about it for a moment, you realize universities like Michigan and like Illinois were not created by the states. They were created by the federal government. The land grant acts after the Second World War that provided the stimulus for states to build this, supported in part to the sale of federal lands. Going back 50 years earlier, my university, which was a territorial university, was once again supported by Congress, sold Indian lands in order to finance this. We believed, as the National Academy study, that it was absolutely vital for the states to understand that these institutions are of vital importance to the welfare of the nation. Cutting support of public research universities and a knowledge-driven global economy is an action against the interests not simply of their states, but against the interests of the federal government. So what to do? Well, we put together a list of recommendations. I'm not going to go through them in detail, but I will go through the ones that I think affect the state universities. While there was strong urging of state universities to make every effort to restore state support, of this 20-member commission, I don't think there was a single member that believed this was in the cards, probably for at least a generation. So part of the challenge is how these flagship institutions of so much importance to their states and to the nation can survive without seeing that as a significant source of support. For that reason, we augmented that recommendation by saying that the states were obligated, therefore, to provide much greater autonomy for public research to universities, to give them the capacity to survive what could be as long as a generation without adequate state support. There are a lot of other recommendations, full cost funding of indirect costs, eliminating intrusive state and federal regulations. We have a major commission right now at the National Academy led by Larry Faulkner, a former executive vice president for academic affairs of University of Illinois and president of the University of Texas, leading that, looking at ways to throttle back these regulations. Immigration was important. We supported the Staple Act. That is, to every degree given to an international student in an area of a national interest, we should staple a green card. Okay, that was kind of part of the Senate's immigration bill, which unfortunately has not made it into legislation yet, but a number of other recommendations. These are all in this material that I've handed out to you. Let me move now to the Great Lakes region. The Brookings Institution, their Metropolitan Studies program that I've worked with for a number of years, believes that the normal geopolitical boundaries we use to define regions like states and so forth really are of less and less importance. What really matters are large multi-state, indeed multinational regions with common economic, demographic, and cultural characteristics that are anchored by major metropolitan areas that really have a global presence. In our analysis of the Great Lakes area, interestingly enough, the Great Lakes has only one of those metropolitan areas, and that's the city of Chicago. Detroit, Cleveland, essentially the cities which 50 years ago might have had that presence no longer do. So in a sense, as goes Chicago, goes the Great Lakes area. It's not just the state of Illinois. Actually, the United States itself. So that's an unusual responsibility, but also an extraordinary opportunity for the University of Illinois. But beyond that, there's a second asset characterizing the Great Lakes area that I think a lot of people don't really appreciate. It has a coalition of universities with the terrible name of the Committee on Institutional Cooperation. That really is the name they give to the provosts that form this group, and it's located, as you may know, on the Urbana-Champaign campus. But that collection of universities conducts more research, produce more scientists, engineers, doctors, lawyers, business executive teachers than any collection of universities in the world, including the University of California, the Ivy League, Oxford, Cambridge, and other leading universities in Europe and Asia. $8 billion a year worth of research. Furthermore, since the 1950s, when the organization was formed, there's a long-standing tradition of cooperation among these institutions, a long history of public service and extension. And so, in a sense, this is a broader asset to use as the University of Illinois thinks about its future, how it harnesses that collaborative activity that's been a part of for half a century. There are a number of recommendations that we made in this particular study to shift perspectives from regional to national to global, which is the world we live in, to shift from competition to collaboration. Let's not try and raid companies from other states. Let's try and build them in our own states, taking a much more strategic perspective of the role of higher education. We believe that in the Great Lakes states, it's going to take a much stronger effort to provide broad education to its public, and that's going to require much greater investment, as well as sustaining the research capability of these institutions. Looking over the border, my university might be thought of as a gas giant like Jupiter, surrounded by two tiny moons that circle about it. The University of Michigan Ann Arbor is probably the largest university campus in the world, $7 billion a year, 34 million net square feet of space, only 44,000 students, but $1.32 billion a year of research expenditures. But I would hesitate to add that because of inadequate indirect cost recovery and the collapse of NIH funding, of that $1.32 billion of expenditures, the university itself invested $380 million. That's another problem we've got to get into. Michigan is a state that has tanked. We came face to face with our mortality when General Motors and Chrysler went bankrupt. Nobody thought they would, but they did. They now make profits. Aging population in Michigan, as in many other states, gives priority to health care, to building prisons, to tax relief, and not to higher education. The support of the University of Michigan from the state has dropped to 4% of our total budget, 7% of our academic budget. I used to get in a lot of trouble as president because I said in the years I've been there, we evolved from a state supported to a state assisted to a state related to a state located university. But with campuses in Europe and Asia, we remain today only a state molested institution. That didn't go over very well, okay? Three Michigan characteristics that are rather unusual. My predecessor, Harold Shapiro, concluded that the university was so large and complex that it simply could not be managed top down. So he started a process over several decades that I pretty much finished off to push most authority over resources and most accountability for expenditures to the level of deans, directors, and chairs. In a sense, those folks generate 95% of our assets. No longer do we drive a big truck up to Lansing and fill it up with state dollars. That's disappeared. So it's student tuition, it's research expenditures, it's private giving, and so forth. So in a sense today, we are a loosely coupled adaptive ecosystem driven by the grassroots. We're very good at repelling invasive species, such as athletic directors that came from Domino's Pizza that we managed to repel last year. It's something that people don't really understand very much about us, but we are kind of convinced that's the only way we can function. Good things happen at the grassroots level on the part of faculty, students, and so forth, and staff. We operate a central bank. During the 1990s, we, like you, had a lot of money socked away in banks earning 1% interest. And so our chief financial officer talked all the parts of the university into pooling all of their reserves, which we then begin to manage as funds functioning as endowment, with the advice of a group of alumni who were very effective at knowing where to put that. Our endowment rose from $200 million to $2.5 billion in 8 years. It's now $10 billion, and if you think about it for a second, that's generating much more today just through wise investment than we'll be ever able to beg for in terms of gifts. So we're kind of like a Harvard, okay? We've become almost a bank. Third, and really important for you folks, Michigan was formed as an institution in 1817 by Congress and by the Territorial Congress. We'll celebrate that bicentennial in 2 years. When Michigan became a state 20 years later, the people associated with the university were involved in drafting that first state constitution. And they identified the University of Michigan as a separate branch of government with total constitutional autonomy. Autonomy over the legislature, over the governor, over the Supreme Court in areas involving academics. Autonomy that was vested in our Board of Regents. But interestingly enough, since the frontier population had no trust or respect whatsoever for government, they dictated that they themselves would elect that board. So every 2 years, university presidents at Michigan go through the horrifying experience of a partisan election, which will determine who they report to after the election. But in any event, that constitutional autonomy is very unusual. There's only one other institution in the country that has it. That's the University of California, and they had it because when they were formed after the Civil War by the Land Grant Act, they were so worried about becoming an agricultural institution that during spring planting season, they quietly took two pages out of the Michigan Constitution and passed it through the California General Assembly before the farmers came back to the assembly. That autonomy, more than anything else, has sustained Michigan as a great institution. We have been very clever from time to time in politely suing the state to establish judicial record. I politely sued them because during my presidency we implemented same-sex benefits. The governor tried to impute the cost of that and deduct us that from our appropriation, and we politely said, no, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to sue you to prove that you can't do that. So it's very strong. The reason I say that is that as you move into the future, your autonomy, your freedom from intrusive regulation and so forth will become one of the most important assets that you can go after. We're seeing that in institution to institution. Virginia's gone through it, South Carolina's gone through it, and we think that's a challenge for you folks to go through.